Accession number 26546, rail 7.
Major Highfield, Rail 7. Now, before we go into the actual action, your role within the regiment and also the organisation of the regiment had changed. I wonder if you could tell us what the nature of these changes was.
Yes. Immediately after we arrived in the Ghazala line and took over gun positions, the regiment, the colonel, decided that myself and my great friend Harold Vanstone, who was the survey officer, would be sent out to troops and other people would be called in. So from now on I was serving with C Troop as the troop leader. The gun position officer was John Poole Hughes, and he eventually became the bishop, a bishop in Wales.
I'll come to that. Now, so you had C Troop. Which battery was that, just to remind me?
Right. The regiment had been also reformed into three batteries as opposed to two, and the third battery was 452 battery, the original batteries being 293 and 296. And I was sent to 452 Charlie Troop, where John Paul Hughes was my gun position officer.
Now, why was this done? And what did you feel about it? I mean, you've got quite a nice little niche at headquarters, in a sense. It was an important job, but an administrative job, largely. How did you feel about it, and why do you think it was done?
I think the colonel, perhaps, knew us, and he knew that we would be... It was time to change things round, and that we should go out to learn the drills on the gunnery positions. And so he made this step. He also sent out John Irvin to be a troop commander, and somebody else took over adjutant. And I was learning, literally, for the first time on the gun positions with 25-pounders.
Now, who were the key figures in your troop? You've mentioned one. Let's have a look at him. John Poole Hughes. Poole Hughes. What was he like, at the time?
He had graduated at Oxford just before the war. And he had come to join the regiment when we came back from the BEF with four other officers who had graduated from the OCTU, system. I was very much a green person, as these officers had been with their men for 18 months, and I had to learn the ropes, and so I was a section officer.
Now, what did it mean to be troop leader? I mean, what was your job? What was the role that you had to do?
Well, we worked together, but one of us had... you had to spell each other in continuous action, but you were actually... I was in charge of the men of two gun sections, specifically. We worked out a very few features in the desert. We worked out innumerable targets for defensive fire, assuming we were attacked. John Paul Hughes always used a slide rule, and I worked them out longhand by Pythagoras. And in front of the gun positions, there was a section post. Called Strickland's Post, 3 or 4 miles out, as a sort of buffer thing. And on occasions, a section of two guns would go out for the day, and there would be some infantry and an observation point, and you would man that point during the day and then come back into the box at night. This was a regular feature.
What was Strickland Post like? Can you describe it?
It was a fairly... It was slightly raised, and we looked across a bit of a valley, which wasn't a valley in the desert, it's just a very small decline. And
so what happened next then, moving on?
I think we move on to the beginning of the battle, which took place on the May the 27th, when Rommel moved his forces round in a series of hooks from the desert up behind the main positions. I must explain here that the 69th, I must explain here that the 150 Brigade was in a box a good way south of us, and that there was a very significant gap between them and the rest of the two boxes of 69 Brigade and then 151. After the initial attacks, Rommel was holed up really behind this box of the 150 Brigade, and he decided to isolate it, which he did, and he destroyed it in 3 days. They put up a gallant defence, but we were not allowed to go to the rescue. We did in fact try to form up a small column to go down in that direction, but by this time the Germans had established air superiority over the immediate front line, and their latest 109 model was too much for the Kitty Hawks on our side. And when this column was forming up, it was dive-bombed by Stukas, who had no opposition, and destroyed. And we lost two officers and quite a number of men.
Where were you during a Stuka attack?
It was forming up in the rear of the box. The transport had been brought forward, and this was a sad day for the regiment. Lieutenant Williams was one of the officers killed. It meant really that we had to just stick where we were. However, the Durhams were very active. The initial attack on the Strickland's outpost had been heavily defeated. Ian English was the infantry officer there, and quite a lot of Italian prisoners taken. The battle went in front of us. We roamed forward into no man's land, the troop commanders going with the columns of the DLI, and fighting very effective battle. I do remember once being at Strickland's post after several days when the colonel came up and some German armoured cars appeared and were having an engagement with two-pounder portées, which was rather one-sided. The portée, the two-pounder has a limited range and is very vulnerable when it's on the lorry. And we watched an encounter. And then the colonel directed some fire onto the armoured cars, and fire was returned back to us, which he then very quickly said, "Order repeat. We don't want them to know that perhaps they've interrupted the control of fire." This encounter finished with the two-pounder portée lost and so on. It was a small thing. The German Air Force had complete control over this front line now, but the 151 Brigade had complete control of their no-man's land in front.
Now, you've not said much about what you were doing during this period of almost 2 weeks. What exactly were you doing?
Well, I was either manning the main position or on one of the detachments going out to Strickland's post. And the position was that only the forward troops on patrol were in touch with the enemy and carrying out offensive operations. During the entire period of about 2 weeks, the division captured 2,000 prisoners and held all its main positions.
So what happened next?
I think that the next thing is we come on to the end of the battle, and one day we knew that there was a severe battles going on in the cauldron, and also the guards' box behind us. And one day, one evening, suddenly all the officers were called to the battery, to the officers' mess, and the battery commander, Bill Cheeseman, told us that there'd been a severe armoured battle the day before. I think this was the 13th, and that we had lost over 100 tanks, and that the balance of power in the desert was now lost, and we were going to have to retreat. He said that this would start that night, that we would have to break out through the enemy lines opposite us, turn to the south, go round Bir Hakeim, and retreat right to the frontier, Fort Maddalena. And so I went back to my troop, and it was arranged that the 8th DLI would go first, and that a section of guns would go with each of the forward parties. I shook hands with Don Paul Hughes, who I didn't know I would not meet for many years after the war. And I went back to my section and told them we were going to break out, that everybody must have a rifle or a Sten gun, and if they went over a mine, I expected them to still have the rifle in their hand at the end. This caused a bit of a laugh. When it was dusk, we moved forward, and there was a lot of firing going on, and some vehicles were hit on fire. But the column I was with had stopped, and after 10 minutes, I thought, this isn't right, and walked to the head of the column to find out what has happened. There was an ambulance on fire on one side, but no more firing. And the driver said he had lost sight of what was happening when the firing took place and didn't know what to do. I realized I must do something, so I went back, called forward my guns and vehicles, and formed the column up into two columns of vehicles about 20 yards apart, and set off on foot on the bearing to lead the thing through. There was a track which had been observable from Strickland's post, where the Germans moved up and down with their supply vehicles and out of range of any of our artillery. We called many tracks, and I took about 2 or 3 hours leading this column with a small infantry section in the front with me as protection towards many tracks. Eventually, when we got up to many tracks, it was a moonless night, and when we got up to many tracks, the leading rifleman said, "There's a barbed wire here, sir."
Now, before we go on to this bit, could you tell us a bit more about how you actually guided the way? Because that's quite interesting in your notes.
Yes.
Because it's quite complicated. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Right. We had to take... We were marching on a compass bearing, and the trouble was that you have to move away from the vehicle, which is metal, to take the bearing. And it's very difficult to get anything to line yourself up on. I lined myself up at one time on the tail of the constellation Scorpio, but I realised after I'd moved a couple of times and we'd checked again that it was moving quite fast. But this was a difficulty. So you marched so far, you stopped, you moved away from your vehicle, you took the bearing, and then you came back again. And eventually we came to a strand of barbed wire, and I sent a couple of infantrymen either way to see if they could find an end. They couldn't. So I decided we'd take the column through. We closed the vehicles up and moved them through in the two column lines. After we'd gone about 400 yards, 400 paces, I just found another barbed wire, and there was an explosion behind, and one of the vehicles had struck a mine. I then arranged for everybody to come from the one column into the tracks of the column that had successfully got through. Three more vehicles blew up on mines in this particular phase. Then I said, "Is everyone through?" And I was told there was a vehicle still stuck, that wouldn't move. The driver had frozen. So I went back on foot and got up on the running board and told him what to do, and that I would run in front of the vehicle and he was to follow me onto the safe tracks. I ran in front of him, and then there was a nasty explosion, and I'd pulled a tripwire of some sort. I felt I was competing with Jesse Owens in the 100 yards, and fell on my face, but didn't lose consciousness. My driver and signaller came to help me and put shell dressings on, and I was quite conscious all the time and able to walk. I thought that it really was not sensible to continue to lead the column, and then went back down and found a captain and called him up and said, "Would you take charge, check the bearings, and let him carry on."
So how bad were your wounds, as far as you knew at the time anyway?
I think what it was a light anti-personnel Italian metal box thing which went off at ground level, and I got sprayed with pebbles and fragments of dust and sand from the top of my head down to my heels. But I had the worst holes were on my waistline and had gone through my web belt, which must have reduced the velocity a bit. The shell dressings were put on these, and from that moment on I retired to the back of my vehicle with the signaller, and the column went on through the night.
Now, was it really painful, driving in a bumpy old truck in the desert with a bad back?
I think when you're in shock you just don't feel anything initially, and it was only later that I felt more considerable pain. The column continued during the night over some very rough ground, then into much smoother desert, and as first light came up we saw vehicles in the distance on our left. Fortunately they turned out to be a party from divisional headquarters, and then we drove all the way back to reaching the frontier wire at Fort Maddalena in the evening. There were whole groups of officers and people there, and Bill Cheeseman I recognised and came forward, and I handed over the vehicles that were with me to him, and we had in fact unfortunately lost one gun in the night when the column had gone too fast, but the others were there. And then I walked across to the casualty clearing post and into the medical chain, saying goodbye for the time being to my regiment.
And what kind of medical treatment did you get?
Well, I was one of the lighter casualties. We were moved by ambulance the next day, and each about 30 or 40 miles. And in the evening, a medical officer would come and look at the various casualties and decide who needed the most attention. I was going to have my wounds redressed after 2 days, but in fact, some more serious case was attended to, and it took me 4 days of about bumpy riding until eventually the ambulances reached the underground dug-in hospital near Mersey Troo. By this time, there was a good deal of pain from the riding, and in fact, one of the worst things was my hands, which had got blisters on all the fingers of light dust. And it was very, very pleasant to be attended to in the hospital, to have my wounds dressed, to have a many tails bandage put round my middle, which was, I hadn't met such a thing before, and to have my fingers attended to and each one bound. I was in very, very contented to have reached this position.
So, what happened next then?
The next day, I was put on the train, because there were railhead at Mersey Troo, and went back to the Delta and finished up very close to where we had first been at El Cassassin, at 28th General Hospital at Tel El Kebir.
And how would you say you appeared there? I mean, you know, were you treated well, would you say?
This was really quite a jolly show. Most people had got broken bones or gunshot wounds, and usually these can be patched up and then you can hop about the place. There was a big spider, and there's three wards off one side and three off another. Queen Alexandra's nurse in charge, assisted by two or three Jewish ATS nurses, VAD nurses, and one huge Sudanese doorman who slept across the door at nights and did moved anything heavy. Two-thirds of the patients were on their feet, bandaged up and able, and brought in to deliver the meals or do anything that was required. The QA had me up on 3 or 4 days as the bits of pebble and stuff worked out to the surface, and I had a session sitting on a chair backwards while she pulled these things out with tweezers. Altogether, I was there for 3 weeks, and then I was sent to Palestine, because the wounds do not heal easily in Egypt, and I moved to a hospital at Sarafand and was 2 weeks there. This was again very pleasant. And after that, I was sent to a rest home on the coast for a further 3 weeks. This was about 10 or 15 miles south of Haifa. And from here, we were able to go on 2 days' leave to Jerusalem and see the sites, which was a very interesting occasion.
Now, how were you by this time? I mean, were you making a proper good recovery? Sounds like you were.
Yes, indeed. Yes, the recovery was steady. And after... it was now 8 weeks since I'd left the regiment, and I was then put on a train to go back to the base depot in Cairo as fit to return to duty.
So you rejoined the unit eventually, from the looks of this, in August.
This was towards the end of August. I'd reached the base depot at El Marza and had been there, I think, about 48 hours. There was no sign of what would happen next. But however, one morning after breakfast, all the officers were in groups round the headquarters tent, and the vehicle drove in from the road, and I was astonished to see it had my vehicle sign on it, and that the officer standing up and looking about the place was in fact Major Collett White, who was our second in command, but he had Z on the front of the vehicle, so he must be now commanding. I rushed over to the vehicle and made myself known, and he said, "Go and get your kit, put it in the truck, and I'll go and fix this straight away with the office here. You're coming back to the regiment. We're only at Mina, in camp, reforming after the retreat."
Were you relieved to get back to the unit? Because you could have been, I suppose, posted somewhere else to another unit.
I think in wartime, it's the friendship of the people that you know and the people that you're with that you want to get back to all the time. And I was very pleased to get back. The regiment was then reforming at Mina, very close to the pyramids. The sand was grey around there from the dust of ages. And the battery... the regiment was reforming as two batteries only, as one battery had mainly been made prisoner in the retreat. And so I was posted as the command post officer to 452 battery, and Bill Cheeseman was my battery commander still.